You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, a new deal could see Iran's uranium processed by Russia. Could this be the answer the West is looking for to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon? Journalist Samira Shackle and counter-terrorism expert Raffaello Pantucci will weigh in on the stories making the headlines around the world. And we'll talk about China's new laser that it claims can shoot down drones seconds after being detected. Then we'll check in with Monocle's David Pleasant in a new segment looking at what's making the news magazines around the world. And today, Italy, what have you found for us, David?
Well, three important titles with three very different takes on the political situation for you, Andrew.
Well, we look forward to hearing from you a little bit later in the show. So all that, plus we'll hear about a series of lost Arabic fairy tales that are making their debut in the English language. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots in the next hour here on Midori House, but before any of that, Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Mali is believed to be free of Ebola, the World Health Organization said today, but 39 people who travelled on buses with a toddler who died from Ebola in the country are still being sought for checks. Meanwhile, Jim Yong Kim, the World Bank Group president, said Asian countries are not contributing enough to the global effort to fight Ebola, despite having a wealth of trained medical personnel who could help stop the spread of the deadly virus.
Especially when it comes to sending health workers. I call on countries across Asia to offer trained health workers now to help stop Ebola at its source. Focusing only on border control is not the right response. The world needs to put the fire out at its source, and because if it doesn't, Ebola could spread to any country, including those here in Asia.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko has ordered army reinforcements to key southern and eastern cities of the country in case of a new rebel offensive in the wake of disputed polls in rebel-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk. He said he was still committed to the current peace process but has proposed cancelling part of it. The peace process was laid out in a 5th of September ceasefire deal agreed in Minsk, Belarus. Angered by the elections, Mr. Poroshenko has proposed scrapping a law that gives special status to Donetsk and Luhansk. Burkina Faso's new military ruler has today pledged to hand power to a civilian transitional government a day before a trio of West African leaders is due in Ouagadougou to press the army to relinquish power. The military appointed Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida as provisional head of state on Saturday, a day after longtime President Blaise Compaoré stepped down and fled to neighbouring Ivory Coast following 2 days of mass protests sparked by his bid to extend his 27-year rule by amending the constitution. Well, Paul Melly is an African expert with the London-based Chatham House think tank. He said the handover process will be complex.
The practical problem they've got is to find somebody with sufficient personal stature to act as transitional head of state, but who is also willing to surrender their own personal political ambitions and right to run in the next election, because obviously the transitional president, if they are to act in a properly neutral manner and ensure the organisation of a free and fair election, cannot then take part in that election themselves.
Talking of elections, US Republicans are poised to make major gains and possibly recapture control of the US Senate in midterm elections today that could serve as a public referendum on President Barack Obama's job performance. Millions of Americans are currently casting ballots to elect 36 senators, 36 governors, and all 435 members of the House of Representatives. And American-based social networking sites have become the command and control networks of choice for extremist groups such as Islamic State, according to Britain's Electronic Spy Agency. The new head of GCHQ, Robert Hannigan, is urging technology companies to work more closely with intelligence services. Vincent McAvaney, a journalist from ITV, thought Hannigan will be rather proactive in his new role.
He's written a sort of comment piece where he sets out the challenges that he faces in his job, arguably one of the most difficult ones, to balance civil liberties with protecting the country, especially in the wake of the Snowden revelations last year. And he's really gone on the offensive. He says that US tech groups are the command and control networks of choice for terrorists, and that they're in denial about the misuse of their sort of platforms for terror and crime.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck, and we're going to be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:06, 14:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is freelance journalist Samira Shackle and senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, Raffaello Pantucci. Welcome both to the programme. Now, there's been a breakthrough in talks with Iran over its nuclear programme. It appears a tentative deal has been struck with Russia that could help secure a wider agreement. Under the proposal, Russia will convert uranium into specialised rods, then send it back to Iran's only commercial reactor. Once the uranium is converted, it's extremely difficult to weaponise. The deal with Russia comes as a 24 November deadline looms over the nuclear talks between Iran and the US and five other nations. And while other issues still need to be addressed, one unnamed US security official told the New York Times, despite differences of opinion on other foreign policy matters, Russia has remained completely unified and with the other countries in the negotiations. Raffaello, let's start with you. What do we make of these? Is this a genuine breakthrough, do we feel?
It could well be. I mean, I'm always a bit sceptical when we come to the Iranian nuclear negotiations, because this is a discussion that we've been having for an awfully long time now, and we hear a lot about these sorts of breakthroughs. But I think that, you know, when you've got Russia, which, as is pointed out in the article, is a country that has remained on track and remained sort of supportive of the Western position on Iran, it's possible. And this does potentially give everyone a sort of reasonable way out by sort of shifting the uranium from Iranian stockpiles to Russian ones. It does kind of take them out of the picture in a reliable way, and does maybe mean that discussions on the sort of bigger program can actually go ahead with the West. So yes, I'd say there is probably reason for optimism. I also think that this is admittedly a long process, but these processes are gradual, and it does take lots of small steps along the way to move towards some sort of success.
Samira, what does it say about Russia and the West? Because we saw yesterday the fallout from kind of rogue elections in the east of the country. It felt that relations between Russia and the West were about to get even worse. But here they are actually playing rather nicely.
I think that the fact is that the diplomacy, sort of effective diplomacy anyway, very frequently involves unlikely bedfellows. And so I don't know if you can necessarily extrapolate a sort of wider softening of Russia-West relations or whatever, which are obviously quite tense at the moment, from the fact that they continued to cooperate on this issue. Obviously, that doesn't detract from the fact that it is a sort of positive thing that they're continuing to cooperate on this issue, despite those other wider disagreements, which are quite heated, I think. And as Raffaello says, I think it's just, you know, it's a very gradual process. And I think it's always, I'm sort of cautious to be too optimistic about Iranian nuclear negotiations, just because it has been such a protracted process. And so many times when it seemed that there's a breakthrough or something's about to be a breakthrough, it's sort of fallen apart. And I think there was a deal in 2009 about which would involve shipping the uranium overseas. And when it was put before the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, he vetoed it. So I think, you know, there's so many stages along the way. It's not just about international negotiations. It's also about Iran's internal politics.
Now, while the huge focus has been on Iran, does it actually matter whether they have nuclear weapons, Raffaele? Because, you know, we head across in the other direction. Pakistan's got them. India's got them. Israel's got them. that it's not exactly a kind of a difficulty if a country has them. It's whether they're going to use them. And the Iranians, first of all, let's say they're not trying to develop them. Why are we so concerned about Iran?
Well, I think this goes back to sort of bigger strategic tussle that you've seen between Iran and the West for some time, right? I mean, this goes back to the revolution and having this sort of revolutionary movement there that's been quite focused on being a sort of anti-Western organization. But then also, on the other hand, it does feed into this endless Sunni-Shia struggle that we see within the sort of Arab world. You know, the Pakistanis are a Sunni country that has got nuclear weapons, but, you know, there's always been that concern that if the Iranians get it, then you're starting to see a conflagration of onward proliferation throughout the sort of Middle East, as all the other Sunni powers in the region, specifically the Saudis, for example, decide that they need to have nuclear weapons. And then as this one sort of academic once told me, he had this great line, he said, you know, it's true that, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, are only dangerous necessary if you use them. But, you know, the more nuclear weapons there are, the more likely one of them is going to get used. And then the more likely you have some sort of catastrophe take place. So I think there is a reason why the sort of there's been such a hard line that's been drawn with the Iranians. But at the same time, I think that what's slightly changed now is the sort of broader background context. You know, now the focus isn't so much on Iran and the nuclear weapons program. That's not occupying front pages in newspapers anymore. What is ISIS. And when you're looking at ISIS, it's a situation where actually the Iranians are fighting against them. And in a way, we're kind of fighting against on the same side there. And that sort of complicated the whole geopolitical calculus. But fundamentally, the idea of the Iranians getting nuclear weapons is something that's been very clearly sort of line in the sand.
And Samira, do you think that's why this deal might work and not get vetoed by the higher echelons of the theocracy this time? Because in fact, it's about time that they confronted the enemy that's over there across the border in Iraq. ISIS is a threat to Iran eventually as well. And it feels that actually this is not the time to be squabbling over kind of nuclear deals.
Perhaps. I mean, I think you can set it in the context of the sort of wider rapprochement between the US and Iran that you've seen ever since Rouhani came to power. And I think that's certainly been more in the last few months that there've been sort of various reports about officials speaking of unofficial cooperation between Iran and the US. That's not unprecedented. You know, it's happened against sort of terrorist groups before. I think it should be seen in that context of a sort of much more communicative and open relationship, which is obviously not going to be the best of friends anytime soon, but perhaps an improvement.
Well, we're going to talk about now about counter-terrorism, because how do you tackle terrorism around the world? Well, one idea being pitched is creating the world's first global counter-terrorism bank. It would hand out small grants, $10,000 to $30,000, to communities to fund projects to stop violent extremism. Money from the Global Community Engagement and Resilience Fund would target projects in Mali, Pakistan, Nigeria, Morocco and Bangladesh too. Meanwhile, the UK's spy chief wants tech giants to open up their servers to allow agencies to have more access to social media to track and quash terror threats. Robert Hannigan, the new director of Britain's Electronic Spying Agency, says tech companies are in denial about the misuse of their technology. Well, a few meaty things for us to dive into here. Raphael, this is certainly your territory. The idea of handing out grants of $10,000 to $30,000 to communities, that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it? Because they're so untrackable.
Potentially, yeah. It really
How
is.
How do you know where that cash goes? It's very difficult to govern where that ends up, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how the GSERF actually lays out how people can apply for grants and then how they sort of award them. I saw some reference of there being a board who will sort of determine these things. I think the general logic of the project is not in itself a bad one. At the end of the day, if we look at sort of what's worked in community counterterrorism programs, it does tend to be on the smaller end of the scale. And it really isn't sort of the huge amounts of money that are always bandied around that are actually required. It's very localized responses. And the idea for this sort of a program would be that it would be able to identify those localized responses and that are actually proving effective and actually give them money to support, you know, whatever little local program they're doing, which is having a very sort of positive effect in, you know, a particularly at-risk area of, let's say, northeastern Nigeria or somewhere in Pakistan's badlands. The problem is, I think, and this is, I wonder how they're going to get over this hurdle, is that, you know, the sort of programs that they're probably seeking to target on the basis of the list of countries I've identified are ones that are probably very, very localized. They may not even have access to the internet. They may have difficulty actually completing some sort of an application form. So I wonder how it is that they're going to sort of make the connection with exactly the programs that they want and not sort of end up funding government approved programs or very specific programs that have other, that maybe are not exactly doing what they're supposed to do. I think it's a great, it's a very ambitious program, and, you know, I very much hope that it succeeds, and there's certainly a huge need for it. But, you know, I also think that there are probably lots of practical hurdles here that we have to yet see exactly how they're going to overcome.
I just wonder, is it a bit too nicey-nicey? If you look at somewhere like northern Nigeria, if you're in a village which is at threat from Boko Haram, you can give as much money as you like to the people who live there. You know, you can fund all sorts of projects. But when someone rolls into town with a gun, it doesn't matter whether you've got an internet or whether you've got a nice kind of, you know, farming projects on the go. That isn't going to kind of... Often it isn't in the communities you're targeting where you're trying to stop people being extremists. You know, the attack comes from without, in a way, don't you think, Samira?
I don't know if I agree with that, actually, because I think that's overly defeatist. Because, I mean, having lived and worked in Pakistan for a year, you know, I saw a lot of these projects, sort of localised counter-extremism projects, and they're incredibly effective. And it's quite a... I don't think it's as simple as giving money to a community and saying fix terrorism. It's a case of the fact that you've got projects which are locally based, which are looking to tackle the root causes of extremism. And it's perhaps an oversimplification to say that extremism is caused by poverty, but it's certainly a big driving factor in many of these areas. And sort of speaking from the things I've seen in the areas of Pakistan, for instance, you know, it's a very simple equation for completely uneducated kids in a remote village somewhere in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa that they can get easy cash and prestige if they sign up to fight with the Taliban. It is as simple as that. So if you're providing them with practical skills, for instance, then that will, if not completely stop all extremism in the area, it will certainly reduce a sort of significant amount of the foot soldiers. And if you can find a way, as Raffaello says, I think that, you know, there's obviously practical issues with getting the cash to the right projects and so on. But if you can find a way of empowering those projects, then I think you would certainly have a very positive effect, sort of reducing the numbers.
But to both of you, don't you think that often you look at communities where we've given the most money, you know, aid flows into Nigeria, flows into Bangladesh, you know, flows into Pakistan, but often it just doesn't seem to be a question of money on the ground. As you say, it's a kind of engagement you can't really often get through money.
I think that's a very difficult one to go either way on. I mean, in some ways, these programs do sometimes have a proven track record of success. I think the other point to make about this particular program is that, you know, you think about the amount of money that's been spent on counterterrorism in the hard kinetic end of the scale, at the hard sort of military end of the scale. You know, if even just some of that is redirected in a different direction, that's going to maybe help develop some of these at-risk communities. That in itself is not a bad thing, where rather than just spend the money on sort of military hardware, which will maybe destroy that same sort of community and potentially sort of exacerbate the problem. I think it's a matter of striking that sort of balance. And I think injecting some of this money in this sort of a positive direction, I think could do no bad thing. It will also generally help the sort of image of countering radicalization and countering extremism, which is not in itself a bad thing.
Samira, do you care if Facebook says to GCHQ, have a look at Samira, who she's been liking of late?
I think that the worrying thing about that is, that there are all the arguments about why security services need greater access to social media, fine. But I think I'm instinctively concerned at a point when you have authorities trying to remove due process. And I think that can be sort of the start of a very slippery slope. And you sort of have this trend of authorities, which ever since the sort of post 9/11 state, where it's this idea that you have to keep giving away more and more freedoms in order to be protected. And I think that I don't necessarily buy that argument.
Raffaello, what's fascinating, you know, here we have, you know, Google and Facebook, who are already kind of feeling slightly punched around post-Snowden, that it's been revealed that they were a little bit kind of too kind of willing to help the authorities. Now here we have the authorities saying, you still aren't doing enough, you've still got to really kind of stop this pretense that you're kind of a world of privacy, and you've got to let us have more access. Do you think that's a fair demand?
Well, I think it's worth tracking back a little bit about this particular article. I mean, we've got to remember, this is Robert Hannigan's first day in his new job as head of GCHQ. So he's very much putting out a stall of saying, you know, what the big priorities are. And he's talking as much to the people within the agency as outside. I think the whole question of Facebook and social media, I think there is an interesting aspect of what's happening there in how we're seeing groups like ISIS use these is not in the old way, which was, you know, secretly hidden away. It's really quite open what they're doing. And so it's a question of accessing as much information as possible. But I think the other interesting point about this particular article is, if you'll note in it, he refers to Edward Snowden a couple of times. And so I think this is as much about the new head of GCHQ sort of showing his support for his new agency and talking about that, as much as it is about the actual issues of privacy and how much the agencies have access to social media and other internet sites.
So we're going to move on 1 second, just but quickly, it always strikes me as amazing that actually, you know, there aren't demonstrations on the street really about this. You know, if they are, they're kind of about 10 people. You know, Edward Snowden...
People switch to Twitter instead. Yes. You hashtag something and then you're off, right?
Edward Snowden, you know, in the 60s would have been a hero, a cultural hero, but you know, he's not. We still go on Facebook, we still use all these social media platforms knowing that people will be able to track us, that we are kind of laying ourselves open. But why doesn't it get people angry?
I guess it's a symptom of the fact that people are so reliant on social media. You probably just join a Facebook group to express your rage with it. But yeah, I agree. It's an interesting shift, I think. And I think probably one that says quite a lot about the way society is moving generally.
And our willingness to give up privacy. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci. When we return, we'll continue our chat about counterterrorism security as we take a closer look at attacks near the Pakistan-India border.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. Bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents. Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci. At least 55 people are dead after a suicide bombing near a tourist attraction on the India-Pakistan border yesterday. The Wagah border is a draw for people who come to watch a colourful military ceremony at sunset every day. As of late, the border has been operating on a heightened security measure following exchanges between India and Pakistan in the north. Officials from both countries are still not clear on which side of the border was the real target for the suicide bomber, but tensions are very high. Raffaello, this is a part of the world that's very complicated to kind of follow what's happening. Ever since the divide of India and Pakistan, you know, they've never been sure of the border. Tension. Do you have any sense of who is to blame behind this, do you think?
Well, I think it seems the TTP, the Tehrik-i-Taliban, Pakistan, seem to have claimed this, or some factions under this sort of umbrella organization seem to have claimed it. It's actually very par the course for Pakistani militant groups who try to instigate the conflict between Pakistan and India. They realize that they're quite small organizations and their sorts of attacks are basically pinpricks against the state. But what they constantly try to do, and we've seen this with Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that was responsible for the Mumbai attacks in 2008, is they try to launch big attacks in India in an attempt to get the Indians to launch a counterattack against the Pakistanis and cause that sort of giant conflict between the two. So in fact, the idea of targeting this sort of a border post where you end up killing people on both sides is kind of exactly their sort of thing. You know, it's very much an attack which has the effect of attacking the Pakistani state while also attacking the Indian state. The Indians will undoubtedly see, as they always do, the hand of the sort of Pakistani security services in this incident in some way, shape or form, and will undoubtedly blame the Pakistanis up to a point. And then the Pakistanis have got their own domestic terrorism problem, which is getting worse and worse. So, you know, I think this does just speak to a sort of problem in Pakistan that we've seen getting worse over the past few years, which is clearly not going to go away anytime soon.
Samira, a part of the world you know well. Yeah. Do you feel that, you know, this will actually pull the two countries together and they'll say we have a common enemy here? Or as Raffaella says, what's easy, it seems to do, is kind of press the button and get Hindu nationalists enraged, you know, Muslim nationalists enraged in the Pakistani side. What's your take on how this could play out?
Well, I don't think it I mean, it's very unusual for there to be a case of Pakistani and Indian authorities working together, unfortunately. But I think what was nice about this in the aftermath was that the authorities on both sides of the border decided not to cancel the ceremony yesterday. And if they had cancelled it, as they were going to, for security reasons, sort of and also as a mark of respect for the 55 dead. Had they cancelled it, it would have been the first time it had been cancelled since the 1971 war between India and Pakistan. And I think that would have been a really big sort of symbolic victory for terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really positive thing that both sides decided to go ahead with that in front of a small crowd, admittedly, but it was an important symbolic thing. And I think particularly within the context of Pakistan, that was an important symbolic act, because it's a country that's quite cowed by terrorism, and you very, very often have politicians sort of capitulating to terrorism. And because the state is not sufficiently strong to secure citizens against terrorist attack, you have a sense of sort of, OK, well, we just won't go ahead with that event. We won't do this. We won't do that. So it's a sort of constant small victories for terror, I think. So from that respect, that was good. I wouldn't hold your breath to see a sort of rapprochement between India and Pakistan anytime soon.
Waiting a long time for that.
Yeah. And this, it comes at a time of particular tension. There's been border firing in Kashmir. There's been inflammatory rhetoric from politicians on both sides. But I would see this incident sort of less in the context of India-Pakistan relations, probably, and more in the context of a TTP that's sort of saying, look, we're still here. Because, since the Pakistani army went into Waziristan in June, there's actually been a big drop in attacks in Pakistan generally. And this was a big high-profile target. And in a way, I'm quite surprised it's never been targeted before, because it's a border crossing, because it's one of the very few places of sort of public space in Pakistan where people can go and just be celebratory and happy. So it was a natural target in all those ways.
Now, let's see if we can fit in a comment from both of you on our final story. This is, China has announced it's developed a laser that can shoot down small drones in seconds. They say they want to use it in urban context to protect their people in case terrorists launch drones. But across the border, it would be super useful for Pakistan to control who's using drones. First of all, Raffaello, do you think Pakistan would actually like to get it? Because then it would have to reveal its hand whether it actually wants these drone attacks to go ahead or not.
I don't know. I'm sure the Pakistanis would like it because they want every sort of weapon they can get. But I also would say that this aspect of the story has once been highlighted in the Indian press, which I think goes back to some of the things I was talking about before between India and Pakistan.
And Samira, would your take on this story be the same? It's interesting, that... Yes, in India, the press has picked up on this, but it would kind of reveal Pakistan's hand, because we never quite understand when they say we don't like these attacks, whether they don't like them or whether they're just saying they don't like them.
Yeah, definitely. I think it would reveal that hand. But, there was a report last year that the Pakistani military had its own secret drones that were sort of passing off as US drones. So you never really know.
And Raffaello, just coming back to the idea of drones falling into the hands of terrorists, it's strange that they are quite cheap and easy to use, but that doesn't seem to be really the weapon of choice for terrorists, does it?
But there's been quite a few plots have been disrupted where people seem to be trying to do it. There's been a number where people were basically building, was it a drone or was it a remote-controlled aircraft toy which they were going to attach some sort of bomb to? And we've seen quite a few instances where there were people who were sort of preparing things in that direction. There was even an incident here in the UK of a group of plotters who were going to take a remote-controlled toy car, attach a bomb onto it, and then drive it under the gates of a TA barracks, Territorial Army Barracks, down in Luton. So it's not been unheard of. I think what people really think is that when they think drone, they tend to think the sort of Reaper drones that we see flying over Pakistan, which are incredibly complicated things, which can sort of launch these, cruise missiles at whatever distance to nail a particular building way down below. That, it's very unlikely that terrorists are going to be able to get their hands on it, because those pieces of kit are very expensive and hard to obtain. But I think in terms of the sort of low-tech side of the equation, we've certainly seen people talking about trying to do it, but no one as of yet has actually succeeded.
And Samira, do you think that will be a concern for the likes of Pakistan, for the likes of India, or all states, if these devices did fall into the hands of the terrorists?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think any sort of new types of weaponry falling into the hands of terrorists is always a concern, especially in a place that's already so ravaged by terrorism. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for joining us here on Midori House. A fine ding-dong through the day's topics, and most welcome as well. So that was Raffaello Pantucci, who's at the Royal United Services and Institute, and freelance journalist Samira Shackle. Thank you both for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Monocle's David Pleasant is standing by to introduce a new feature on the show, looking inside the covers of the weekly magazines. But before we get started, here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. Mali is believed to be free of Ebola, the World Health Organization said today. But 39 people who travelled on buses with a baby who died from Ebola in the country are still being sought for checks. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko has ordered army reinforcements to key southern and eastern cities of the country in case of a new rebel offensive in the wake of disputed polls in rebel-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk. Burkina Faso's new military ruler has today pledged to hand power to a civilian transitional government a day before a trio of West African leaders is due in Ouagadougou to press the army to relinquish power. And US Republicans are poised to make major gains and possibly recapture control of the US Senate in midterm elections today that could serve as a public referendum on President Barack Obama's job performance. Millions of Americans are currently voting to elect 36 senators, 36 governors, and all 435 members of the House of Representatives. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. And the time here in London is 18:31, which means it's 19:31 in London. And today we're adding a new feature to the programme. Every Tuesday and Thursday, we'll be taking a closer look at what weekly publications in a country are writing about. Today, we start by looking at what's inside the pages of the Italian weeklies. And joining me in the studio is Monocle's David Pleasant, and a man with a fine Italian heritage as well. So you're actually able to read these in Italian, I should point out. Now, where are you starting today?
So I'm going to start with L'Espresso, which is traditionally the centre-left weekly magazine. It's of the Espresso Publishing Group, which also owns La Repubblica. So quite aligned with that newspaper. The front cover we should mention first is it has a broken piggy bank.
What's the Italian for piggy bank, do you know?
God, don't put me on the spot. I don't know.
Il piggy banky.
Banca del...
yeah, that's fine. We'll move on. I won't test you.
Fine. What that's referring to is the new tax laws that are felt by the magazine to be putting their hands on Italy's savings in a kind of misadvised way, further kind of not helping growth in any way, putting at risk any future growth, the cover says. But what I thought we'd kind of go through is some of the regular features that the magazine is kind of famous for. The very first editorial letter is from Roberto Saviano, who listeners might know from the Gomorrah film. He's got a regular feature on the magazine, and he's gone into a kind of quite interesting essay about ISIS, the IS group, and how they put in hands of those who hate Islam even more strength. So it's basically a weapon to those who are anti-Islamic.
Okay, and you've got a few little pink post-its in there. Let's go to the second one.
Yep. So I thought we'd go kind of some of those regular features that I mentioned. Another one that I really like about the Espresso is that they always choose the cover that they didn't choose for this week. So they have the alternative cover.
So on the cover we have a kind of fat piggy bank cracked.
Yep, and on the the other cover, as the piece is called, is the story about the scraps of what's left of the Democratic Party, and how Renzi is actually trying to get his hands on the treasury of that party in a bid to get rid of the ex-communists that he feels are too strongly involved in the dealings of the centre, the left, main left party, of which of course he belongs.
So well, I can see why they didn't go for that. So the other cover was a kind of a tattered flag for the party.
So you don't really like that. It's not very exciting, is it?
No, it's not very exciting, and I think the piggy looks nicer.
It is. It's much more striking. But I like that kind of editorial line of showing what they kind of had in mind.
Yeah, they do it a little bit in they kind of show you how they made the cover in Bloomberg Business Week, which is another one, a nice one.
Exactly. It's kind of like insider editorial kind of view. And then finally from that, I thought we'd look at a kind of good news story coming from the Espresso. They've done the whole kind of last third of the newspaper is a good news story coming from Tuscany and Umbria. They're saying along the road of Kashmir, and how, unlike a lot of the other regions in Italy, both Tuscany and Umbria are showing really encouraging growth in just about all sectors, especially manufacturing and innovation, and a kind of mix of those both. There's a sort of feeling that perhaps Tuscany will be the Silicon Valley of the luxury market of Europe. So, kind of good news story.
And why is it a kind of a Kashmir road?
Traditionally, a lot of the Kashmir mills and kind of manufacturing was in that area of Tuscany with the border with Umbria.
Okay, well, let's bounce on.
Bounce on. The next one I thought we'd look at is Internazionale, International. Interestingly, this is a collection of viewpoints from the foreign press and just about everywhere outside of Italy. So, I mean,
which they then translate into Italian.
Which they translate with a very capable editorial team. It's an independent publication. It's not owned by a larger group. So I thought we'd look at the...
And they've got a big monocle... not a monocle, a big McDonald's M.
They've got...
A monocle M, that would be good. A big McDonald's M. We're just like McDonald's, that's correct. They've got... Why is that... What's that story about?
They've gone with the story about the minimum wages in...
Oh, yes.
In the United States, and the fight for unionization of a lot of the fast food workers in North America. But I thought it would be more relevant to talk about what the non-Italian press are saying about Italy. And that's really the section that I think a lot of readers of this really go for. They've gone for a piece from La Vanguardia in the Catalan Daily. Warning that comes from Genoa is the piece. It's basically going through this large Italian city of Genoa and kind of a warning to the people of Barcelona of how they should watch out of where things can go wrong. So a little bit of a depressing piece, really. Mismanagement of infrastructure, all sorts of kind of crises that have led Genoa to be rather a depressing place in terms of economy.
Now, is this because Barcelona is thinking of going independent, or Catalonia is? Are they saying that if you kind of mismanage a city state, because although Genoa is obviously part of Italy, it is a bit of a kind of a separate enclave in many ways.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this piece starts by talking about where Genoa went wrong way back, as opposed to Venice, which had all sorts of riches and managed to maintain somewhat of its wealth for a longer time than Genoa did. But there is that kind of nation state, that city state feeling about this article. Really interesting stuff. And I think it's fascinating to have that kind of cross Mediterranean reference, the view from Barcelona for Genoans.
So get some gondolas if you're going to survive.
Exactly.
That's the story. And next, you've got more post-it notes than I don't know.
Yeah, brimming with post-it.
A post-it note king. Next.
Next is from The Guardian, the United Kingdom's Guardian. This is a young Italian migrants are not protected. Young migrants to Italy are not protected by the law. This is kind of interestingly with what's happening in Britain. Britain refusing to fund the Mare Nostrum Italian programme. This is actually the view from Britain that actually once Italy welcomes or allows these people to enter its shores, they're left basically destitute. So another quite depressing story from the foreign press, which Italians are reading.
It's not very cheery going to the newsstand in Milan today, for example. Now, finally.
Finally, we may be a little bit more upbeat. This is Panorama, that's part of the Mondadori group. So perhaps equivalent of, I don't know, The Spectator, perhaps sort of centre-right paper, newspaper, magazine, I should say. Their cover is The Other Matteo, L'Altro Matteo. So it's talking about the kind of aspiring leader of the Lega Nord, Matteo Salvini. So this is kind of, and it's quite interesting, they've kind of done a direct comparison between the two Matteos. So this is kind of...
So the Lega Nord, they would like that part of Italy to be independent.
They would, but it's really complicated, and I always try and get my head around it, but they have a lot of voters who are not in that part, so they'll even have voters in the south. So it's basically a quite far-right paper. You might compare it to the Front National in France, and there's even a picture of Matteo Salvini with Marie Le Pen and the Dutch Geert Wilders, the other very right-wing party leaders.
What's interesting, there's a cover. They've gone for a classic kind of grey portrait. Quite cool. I like the font for Panorama on the heading. The other two are kind of proper news dailies, aren't they? Red, splashes, quite loud. A very interesting different art direction for them as well.
Yeah, a bit more subtle. And I actually think that Panorama have recently done a redesign, and it's actually a better read. It feels a lot more comfortable to read. And the infographics that then go on to talk about Renzi in a kind of cynical way, you might expect that from a centre-right or right-leaning paper. This goes into at what point is Renzism, if we can translate that into English, kind of analysing at what point Matteo Renzi is and who's on his side and who isn't. And then I thought we'd finish on this little piece that they've done. What can Matteo Renzi do it? And four biographies on Matteo Renzi respond. There's already been four biographies.
And do they think he can?
Well, a lot of these are really negative, these biographies, so no one seems to be
going Pleasant, positive. We will have you back to do this, but that was probably the least cheerful run through any weekly magazines in the world I've ever had.
I'm sorry, Andrew, we'll think of really cheerful. We'll talk about ice cream and pizzas or something.
No, but thank you. So that's a new series that we're going to do here. Well, we're going to do it twice a week. We're going to do it on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We're going to head to a different country, look at the weeklies that sit on their newsstands and see what they're saying about that nation. But as a first off, David Pleasant, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, Tales of the Marvellous and News of the Strange.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. A tattered manuscript found in a Turkish library is getting a new life in the literary world. Tales of the Marvellous and News of the Strange contains lost stories about monsters, legends of lost princes, and the misadventures of a princess that becomes a gazelle. This is the first time these stories have been translated into English. Well, to talk about the collection of tales is the author Robert Irwin, who's written the introduction to the book. Welcome to the show. First of all, you should tell us a little bit about the history of this book. So it was translated into German in the 1930s, but this is...
It was published in Arabic in Germany in the 1930s. Okay. It's only in 1984 that a team of German scholars got around to translating it. And what they produced was essentially a translation for scholars. So the annotation is all about philology and tale types and so forth. But when Malcolm Lowndes and I decided to do an English translation, we took the same strategic decision as we'd done when we worked on a translation of the Arabian Nights. That is, we were producing a work of literature that was for entertainment purposes primarily, rather than a subject to academic study.
And I should slightly correct myself, because some of these stories have been translated before. They have appeared in Tales of 1001 Nights. Is that correct?
Yes, but that's one of the interesting points about it. There are two interesting points about it. First, the tales that are common to the Arabian Nights, and then the ones that aren't. They're both interesting and important. The interest in the tales that are common to the Arabian Nights and to Tales of the Marvellous is that the stories of Tales of the Marvellous seem to precede those of the Arabian Nights, and the people who worked on compiling the Arabian Nights seem to have drawn on Tales of the Marvellous. So now we have the translation, we can look at how the people who worked on the Arabian Nights tailored their stories. They cut bits from the earlier manuscript, they added bits here and there. It's interesting to see how the people who worked on the Arabian Nights took literary decisions.
And who did work on these stories? Who were the authors? Is it a collection of authors over time who gathered these stories together?
If we're talking about Tales of the Marvellous, or for that matter, Arabian Nights, the flat answer is we don't know. There have been some balmy guesses in the past, but we really don't know. Very carefully anonymous. My view is that Tales of the Marvellous was put together by a single person. He collected some of the stories from pre-existing sources, but I think he was a creative writer himself. And I get the impression this is a man exploding with ideas, writing in a hurry. Absolutely fantastic. He's scribbling away. You know, I'm a novelist myself, and I can see the signs of it. He can get sort of pages into a story, and he suddenly realises he hasn't given his protagonist a name. Oh, so he bungs a name in, and from then on the prince becomes Mahoob or something.
And in the introduction, it's explained that in certain instances, he forgets what bit the story he's already told. Somebody who's kind of not a virgin suddenly becomes a virgin, for example.
Yes, the tale of the 40 girls, the prince in this enchanted castle where he sleeps secretly with one of the girls after another. The 40 girls run the castle, and the first night he sleeps with the big sorceress and finds her to be a virgin. Then he sleeps with everybody else, one by one, and they don't know. And then he gets round to her again, and because the narrator's forgotten he's already slept with her, he finds her a virgin again. There are all sorts of ludicrous pieces of carelessness. Mind you, you get that in the Arabian Nights as well.
And why are these stories important?
Because they're new. I mean, because they're unknown. I mean, something like 16 of these stories are quite unknown previously. They add to the body of folklore and fantasy that we have. They add to the Arabian Nights, to Grimm, to Andersen, to Perrault, all the great story collections. There's some amazing stories here. And there are also slight differences between this story collection and the Arabian Nights, although they are similar. This one is wilder, madder, more determinedly surrealist, keener on magic.
Now, some of the stories, we said, they feature princes, and there is lots of religious references here, but there is a kind of a sense of, you know, of adventure here. Is there a kind of a connection with, you know, the same period almost in Europe, in medieval tales? Are we seeing the same kinds of stories unfolding in Shakespeare and, you know, in medieval stories and all sorts? I wondered if they all have the same kinds of heroes.
That's a tricky question. It is striking how prejudiced this story collection is in favour of princes and princesses. Only princes are princes, the only kind of men that can have true romances. If you're lower class, I was going to say you're fucked. Your attempts at sort of seducing beautiful women are almost doomed to comedy and disgrace. True love is reserved to the aristocracy.
Now, you also explained that the stories are written in slightly vulgar form of Arabic. They're not kind of, it's not a grand collection of stories. And, you know, is that because they were meant for a wide audience?
They were meant for a wide audience. And it's also the case that fiction for a very long, well, effectively until the 19th century, fiction was not regarded as a form of high literature in the Arab world. Poetry was regarded as such. Essay writing was regarded as such. But storytelling had very low status indeed. The centuries of contempt for the Arabian Nights.
And when you're luring people in to buy I have a really beautiful copy here, a really collector's copy. But tell me, when you're luring people in, give us an example of one of the stories that you felt enchanted by.
Enchanted and horrified by.
Horrified would be good as well.
It's the longest story in the book, fortunately. The tale of Arus al Arais, the bride of brides. It's too long to summarise, but basically this woman is a kind of latter-day Medea, and she seduces men and jinn, and she kills everyone she sleeps with, and she kills quite a lot of other people as well. And all the time she's looking for true love, and she never finds it, and she's betrayed. but she's also a kind of super, super bitch. And it's extraordinary style. And it's also the way it's narrated. It's sort of one narrator said, I had this from somebody, and then somebody else picks up the tale, and then there's a story within that, and then there's another story. It's absolutely bemusing.
Robert, we really haven't given you enough time. It sounds a marvellous, marvellous book. And that's the title. It's called Tales of the Marvellous and News of the Strange. And that was the author, Robert Irwin, who has written a really wonderful introduction to the book. And it's going to be available from this Thursday. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us. Well, it's Tuesday, and that can only mean one thing. Yes, it's Tuesday. No, it's time for our weekly music review. And this week, we're dimming the lights and polishing our horns as we talk jazz. That's quite an introduction, isn't it?
Well, stop it. Stop okay. it, Billy. It's not that scary, I promise you.
I think polishing the horn is. Anyway, we welcome one of the UK's leading lights in jazz music, the singer, the pianist, the producer, and the friend of Monocle 24, Ian Shaw. Ian, welcome back to Monocle 24. We're also going to be talking about the EFG London Jazz Festival, which is launching on Friday, the 14th of November. It's London's biggest musical festival, involving venues including the Barbican, the Royal Festival Hall, the legendary Ronnie Scott's, and many, many more. Now, there's a plug and a half. Right, let's start, Ian. Have I done enough of a plug for you, or are we going to start with the music?
It's entirely up to you.
You tell us about the festival first of all.
Well, it's an extraordinary event because it's magnanimous and huge by its existence. It's over 350 events, some of which take place from the tiniest coffee shops, Foyle's bookshop, for example, to schools. It has a sort of wonderful outreach program, so it's not just kind of, it's not kind of centrophilic. That's
another nice word.
It stretches out to gospel choirs, to kids, to families, and then of course the bigger spaces are used absolutely beautifully, and bringing people from all over the world to collaborate, sometimes with
British organizes players.
It's organized by a wonderful team of people called Sirius Productions, and they've been doing it for some time now, and they know what they're doing, and they're very all embracing. So it's not just about the local thing, it's about linking the music to the rest of the world. And also it's very genre sort of encompassing. Jazz has always been a broad church. It tips over beautifully sometimes into classical, sometimes into pop and soul, certainly rock and blues. So it's not just that scary kind of jazz word. It's not just people wearing beanies with Czech shirts.
I said the jazz word in a jazzy way, but now, but just tell me, is that a bit of a problem actually for some of the younger audience? Audiences, the jazz, they don't realise how many tendrils it has into every kind of music in a way.
I think it used to be. I think less now, because it's introduced at a kind of an early academic level that you can. In the 80s, when I was doing my degree, I did music, composition, analysis, history. There was no jazz. There was nothing other than, linking it directly to Michael Tippett or something. So there happened to be a blue note in one of the symphonies. And now kids are prepared, and they love it. And it crosses over into all sorts of R&B things that they recognise. What we don't want is it to become stylish again, which is what happened to it in the 80s. There was a silhouette of a saxophonist playing in every wine bar window. No, thank you. It has a bit more substance and soul than that.
Okay, well, let's hope there's no sax in here, because otherwise you'll have your downfall. This is Mark Lockhart, and this is the first track that you've chosen for us. This is called Believe It or Not.
Yeah, happy for you to fade this down after a while.
He's back. We're back on air. That was Believe It or Not by Mark Lockhart.
Mark wouldn't mind that at all.
Okay. Who is he?
He was one of the leading lights in the 1980s. He was a part of a collective called Loose Tubes, which was put together essentially by two composers and musicians, Ashley Slater, who's a trombonist, who recently was on Britain's Got Talent with his girlfriend, was shamed, but I think there was some sort of postmodern irony in his appearance. And Django Bates, who's a keyboard player and a composer, and they had this incredible collective, which this year and last year they brought back as a sort of 35-year recognition of their skills, and they've all moved on to different things now.
And normally it's just instrumental. It doesn't work with singers, or
no, not usually. Which was kind of quite a refreshing thing in those days, because you know we wanted something different. We wanted a channel where these wonderful instruments could be employed, not just orchestrally. And Mark is doing an incredible thing on the 20th of November at the Purcell Room, called Movers and Shakers, where he gets together a whole lot of musicians that were influenced by the bands, the British bands, British, horrible word to say, the British bands of the past 100 years, and the collaborations with people like Joe Harriet from the West Indies, our famous Stan Tracy, who died last year, Hugh Warren, who's Welsh, and Ray Noble, who wrote The Very Thought of You.
Okay, well, we're going to move on because we haven't got much time. I want to hear the last two tracks. This is called Love is a Losing Game, and it's Sashal Vasandani.
Yeah.
Love is a losing hand.
Though I'm battle blind. Well, we're only giving you short snippets, I'm afraid.
That's
today.
Okay.
That's because we're fitting so much in. But he's going to be appearing at the Barbican on the opening night of the festival here in London. His most recent album is called High Fly. What do we need to know about him?
There aren't many blokes singing jazz. There are plenty of sort of post-Sinatra bad crooners. We don't need any more of those, thank you very much. He's soulful.
They're all on Britain's Got Talent.
They really are. Yeah, big band week. He's wonderful. He's based in New York. He's half Indian, half American. He has wonderful kind of cultural mix of musical influences. And that first night, which I'm co-hosting at the Barbican, is extraordinary. It's a huge orchestra with a brass section conducted and arranged by Guy Barker, with the most extraordinary lineup of singers, you know, that come from the pop world and the soul world. Vula Malinga, who's worked with Basement Jacks, she's one of the singers in Basement Jacks, she'll be singing, and Sachal will be performing. And it's the whole concert is based on anniversary, the notion of anniversary, and commemoration and celebration. So it's a wonderful opener.
I've got more questions, but I can't have them because we need to hear the last track. This is Cry Me a River by the legendary Georgie Fame.
Now you say you're lonely. You cry the whole night through. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river.
We have but seconds, I'm afraid. Georgie Fame, as I said,
yeah, the old vanguard, yeah. Somebody who took American jazz music and made it particularly strangely British in the early 60s and got together with Americans, black American musicians, and beautifully, I was with him the other night on stage at Ronnie Scott's, and he's going to be a great asset to the jazz festival.
And just tell me, when people see him live, is it I often wonder with jazz, is it an emotional experience? Is it a thing of beauty? Is it, you know, what's people's reaction normally when they see someone like that on stage?
It's very real, and it's about the moment. It's not based on posturing. It's not based on. It certainly isn't based on style. As soon as it is, we go away.
Okay, well, that's Ian Shaw, who's promising you no silhouettes of trombones or anything else. Thank you so much for
welcome.
Joining us. A great friend here of everyone at Monocle 24. And the EFG London Jazz Festival runs from the 14th to the 23rd of November in venues all across London. And that's all we have time for.
on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci. Today's show was produced by Emily Elias. It was researched by David Pleasant and Amanda Valmorbida. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. After the headlines, it's Section D, and that is, of course, our design show. And then at 2200 hours, stick around for our next news and current affairs show, which is, of course, the Monocle Daily. And this show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. And don't forget, the next Weekly's Review, our new segment, is going to be here on Thursday. So make sure you're listening then. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.